welcome to the second episode of the Dicey Review. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a number of different topics, including what's new in the board game industry. And we'll also tell some stories about our board gaming experiences and run over the games that we've been playing. And we're also going to discuss themes of board games and how those themes have kind of affected our play experience and how they are may or may not be important to us in gaming. So once again, tonight, I've got Chris and David with me, my two brothers. So, Chris, what's up? How you doing?
Good. How are you doing? What's up with you?
Not much, man. Just ready to podcast. I'm ready to do this. David?
Let's podcast it up.
Yeah. What's up with you?
I'm also super stoked to podcast. Ready. Having a great time.
Yes. Yeah. We've been needing to get back together and do this. We're going to start
podcasting. We're drinking coffee. It's good times.
Yeah. Having a good time.
Yeah, it's true. I've got my Norma's mug. Oh, such a good one. It's really high quality. We're going to start things off with Tales from the Tabletop. David has a story that he wants to tell this week about Resistance.
Yes, Resistance Avalon.
Yeah.
So we have our normal D&D group, which gets together on Sundays, but it's a big group. It's seven. So there's six players and a DM. So scheduling is tough. I mean, there are just times that we just can't get everyone together, you know, but then it really stinks if it's like one person can't make it and six others can. And we're like, let's just get together and play games or something. So we did. And one of the people in the group is very new to board gaming. He's our DM actually. And he's been, you know, playing D&D since he was, I mean, for 20 years, he's been playing D&D, but as far as board games go, he's pretty new to it. So we're like, hey, we can play some board games. Well, then you run into the issue of, okay, we've got, you know, six people. So it kind of limits which games you can play. So we were like, well, let's play the Resistance Avalon. It's awesome. It's one of the games that we love to play, even with a smaller group, but you know, it accommodates a big group. Great. And for those of you who don't know, Resistance Avalon is it's a hidden role game. So basically everyone gets a role. You're either red team or blue team. And you go around and you vote on whether or not missions pass or fail. If the red team wants the missions to fail and for everyone to lose, the blue team wants for everyone to win. But if you out yourself as a red team member, as you know, a spy, then they know that you're on the bad team and they won't send you on missions, so you don't get to vote. So you have to keep your role hidden, but you have to try to sabotage everything. So we're playing this, and there's a couple of special roles. You know, you have people who know who the bad guys are, and or know who one of the bad guys are, and then you have other people who don't. Well, one of the roles is Merlin, and Merlin knows who Morgana is, and Morgana is a red agent. At the end of the game, though, there's an assassin. One of the red agents is an assassin, and if the blue team wins, the assassins have one more chance, and their chance is to assassinate Merlin. And if they assassinate Merlin successfully, they win, and the blue team loses. So if you're Merlin, you can't give away that you're Merlin. It's very important. So we're playing this. We have all our roles, and I'm just a regular blue guy. I'm always just a regular blue guy when we play the Resistance Avalon. And I'm always like, I'm just on the blue team. I got nothing else. I can't lie. There's nothing I can do. Just I vote to win. So, but I'm always trying, you know, to figure out. So we're playing through and we're having a good time. And our guy who is new to it, he's just like, come on, let's just play. Like, no, man, talking about it. It's part of the game. You know, so finally we're getting into it and we're talking about, you might be a spy because you did this, but you sent so-and-so. Why did you say that way? You know, and we're getting there and we get to the very end and it's like, we're down to the wire and we're like, okay, let's turn over these votes. You know, so we're revealing votes. We're like, pass, pass, pass. We did it. You know, the last one. Yeah, we won. And then it's like, wait, you know, so one of the other guys who's the most, he's probably the most devious member of our board game group. And of course, the one who owns the Resistance Avalon. He's like, wait, the assassin has a chance to kill Merlin. So he turns to the player next to him. He's like, so who do you think Merlin is? And the player next to him is like, oh, man, I mean, I vote him. And he points to one of the blue team guys. He's like, ha, it's not me. I'm not Merlin. And the new guy, our DM, turns over. He goes, it was me. I was Merlin all along. And then the original guy, the devious guy, goes, good, because I'm the assassin, not him. I assassinate you. So he immediately goes, that's it. I'm done. I'm never playing this game ever again. So because of his principles, he could never play the Resistance Avalon again, but he liked it so much that he went out the next day and bought the Resistance and played that with his friends at work. And so we brought him in, but he said, I promise you, I will never play that game ever again. So it was funny. It was hilarious. And we were like, really? Are you going to be like that? Really? And he's like, yeah, I really am. I'm really going to be like that.
That's a man that sticks to his principles.
I'm telling you, he's a principled man, be it right or wrong. But yeah, so that's what happened. It was hilarious. And we laughed. And he literally left. He just left. He was done with game night from that point on. So we played something else.
Wow. He literally actually
he got up and walked out and was done. He's like, I feel like I was cheated. I feel like I didn't understand the rules.
I've been there.
Oh, yeah. But it, yeah.
Playing Imperial Settlers for the first time, finding out something new like 3/4 of the way through the game. Paul.
That was Seven Wonders for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. By the way, you can do this and this. Oh, really? That would have been nice to know like an hour ago.
Are you talking about the fact that when you put down production cards, you get them when you build them?
I don't know. It was something. I don't remember.
Because
exactly.
I explained that in the rules.
No, there was something that wasn't explained clearly. I remember distinctly. Oh, well, that would have been nice to know.
Talking about the division.
For me, it was playing Seven Wonders. And at the end of the game, the guy who taught the game going, oh, yeah, and by the way, these cards are exponential if you're number one in them. So this is 45 points. Okay. Yeah. Well, then we would have stopped you from doing that had we known.
That would have changed my strategy.
That's not good.
Yeah. But Seven Wonders is a great game. So.
Yeah, for sure.
That's my story.
Okay, cool. Okay, so I was trying to think. I've been playing a whole gaggle of Euros, which hasn't lended itself to super interesting stories, but I've noticed a trend, and I will point this out. So recently I've been – I figured out that there's a BGG app on your phone. That's what I've been
– It's wonderful.
It's really cool. It is.
So why don't you explain really quick what Euros are for those people like me who didn't know what they were until like 2 weeks ago.
So Euros were kind of started with Settlers of Catan whenever it initially came out. And it's basically a game that really heavily relies on
A style of board game. When you say Euro, you're talking about a type of game.
Right, right. It's a style of board game that's usually characterized by victory points and by certain types of mechanics. So like if you have worker placement, or if you have set collection, or if you have drafting, certain things like that, resource management. A lot of those are typical Euro type games. The games that most of the time Euros are really thinky games. They're games that you can develop a strategy and it works. You can develop an engine. Ameritrash games came along afterwards, and they were really heavily thematic. And it was like, you know, Battlestar Galactica, and there were hidden roles, and there were all kinds of cardboard chits and minis and things like that you'd throw around, and they really focused on a whole lot of components and heavy.
As long as they're not Chads, those are problematic.
Yeah, those are bad.
They're actually called chits, C H I T S. Which you have to
make sure you really enunciate.
Really careful.
Say that.
Yeah. So just as a point of clarification, a really succinct definition of Euro game, it's a German game or Euro style game. It's basically any class of tabletop game that has simple rules, short to medium playing times, indirect player interaction, and abstract physical components. That's typically general definition of Euro game.
Yeah, and you will normally know a Euro game when you see it on a table. There are a lot of times you will know a Euro game when you see it.
By what?
By the types of resources that are out on the table, by the fact that there are meeples. That's a big
meeples. And then just kind of generic, like you look at things and there's some generic resources, a generic map.
Right.
You know, it's not super themey, basically, as typically.
Okay. Yeah, a perfect example of that is one of the games that I was going to talk about in our top three, the Lagrange or Lagrange, however you pronounce that. You get 25 little cubes in that game, or little cylinders, and they represent wheat, olives, wine, pigs, grain, like all this stuff. And it's just a little cube, and you, based on where you put it, it's that thing. It's just very bland. A lot of people think that Euros don't have a lot of theme and things like that.
Think Lords of Waterdeep, which actually I like the theme on that one, but it's a Euro game for sure.
So I've been playing a lot of Euro games. And we've been playing the Voyages of Marco Polo quite a bit. And I know the last time we did a podcast, we had talked about my father-in-law when he came back and tried to you know, win based on some bonus points that we didn't count.
Knocked on your door at 4 a.m. I won.
Yeah, it was like 10, 15 minutes after the game. It was hilarious. So we've been playing a lot of that, and I have been logging all of my plays, and it has turned into a tale of woe, of misery and sadness. Like every game, I've been logging all the games, and I realized when I was playing last night that I've never won the game. And not only have I never won the game, every time by like the fourth or fifth round, when it's getting near the end, I just realize that I'm discouraged and sad and like leaning my head against the table, like, oh, I just want to go to bed, you know? So, and I'll read you, I've been writing down the different plays. So I've got six different ones here, and this will give you a little bit of an insight on how my feelings have progressed over this voyage that I've taken with Marco Polo and three other people. Lacy wins 55-42, blech. Lacy 54, Billy 51, Paul 33. Man, this game is a brain burner. So now I'm like, oh yeah, it's mechanics. I've just got to learn the theme. You know, I've just got to learn how to. Lacy 86, Connie 59, Paul 33. This game is crap. Let's play again. And so it just goes on. And like the last time we played it, it was Lacy won with 71. I had 53 and her dad had 45 points. And it was period. Lacy wins again, ... I'm not sure ever win this game. It has sucked the joy, but I want to play it so bad. It's such a fun game, but I will say
Marco Polo. Right?
Yes. Yeah. I will say it's been a slow descent into depression and madness every time I play this game because I cannot, like, I figure out, I'm like, all right, I've got the strategy. I was trolling Board Game Geek, the forums. I'm like, how to win Marco Polo.
And how to beat your wife at Voyages of Marco Polo.
Putting in her specific name, how to make Lacy sad. No. And I found a strategy guide and everything, and I still have yet to beat Lacy. Her and her mom are a whiz at that game. Like, they just get it. I don't know. I came close. One game I had 53 and her mom had 55 points.
Nice. So does Lacy really love this game?
Yeah, and in large part due to the fact that she's lost like once out of the seven right. times that we've played it.
Right.
And the funny thing is that I'm always talking to her, I'll be like, yeah, let's play Imperial Settlers. She's like, oh, I hate that game. Why? I always lose at it. So it's not that it's a bad game. It's just that she hasn't won at it. Like, we've played it probably four or five times, and she's not lost one of those times. She's never won once, but so anyway, I'm kind of in the same boat as her. But yeah, it's been an interesting journey with Marco Polo. But man, such a good game. It's a really good game. I recommend it highly for anyone who can find it. It's in between print runs right now, so it's $70 on Amazon, and its MSRP is $60. So I would hold off right now.
Yeah, I'm the same way though. Like, even if I don't win games, if it's a good game, I still love it. And some people, if they lose at a game consistently, it just ruins it for them. Not for me. I'm just like, nah, if it's good. I mean, I don't think I've won Machikoro yet, and I still will play anytime anyone wants to play that game. Splendor, same way. I keep losing at it, but I'm like, let's play.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the way it is with me. I get, if I'm just really getting just demolished, I'll just be like, I'm done. I know I'm going to lose this one. So I'll get, you know, I'll just get kind of lax towards the end of the game, but I would set it up again and play right after. It's that good. Just the mechanics and the different kind of routes to victory. So,
yeah.
But anyway, do you have anything interesting happen this week, Chris, as far as as you said, you were playing Dice Masters.
Yeah, I was playing earlier tonight. We had a new set that we haven't gotten to play with yet. We have some new Avengers cards and yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's a game that I really enjoy. It went down to the wire. You know, Dice Masters is great, but it's basically a dice combat game. You can choose hero cards. Each one gives you a special ability, and then you roll it. There's some cool mechanics there, but there's a few things. It's kind of like Magic the Gathering in that you can get, in Magic, you can get what's called mana flooded, meaning you're drawing nothing but mana. You don't have anything to do with it. And I kind of got that situation where everything costs energy to field characters and to use abilities and things like that. And there's different types of energy. With your character dice, you can either roll a character and feel it as a character to attack with, or you can roll it as energy. And I got some really big, powerful guys, and Kingpin was my character. He gets big. He gets really big, but he's expensive to field. Well, I bought both of my dice. You have to buy your character dice. I bought both of my dice, and I had two Kingpins. I drew two Kingpins. I'm like, I'm going to roll these things, and I rolled double energy on both of them. So I'm like, that's okay. You get one reroll. So I rerolled again, double energy. So I literally didn't get to field any of my characters until it was way too late. So my son beat me. I keep rolling energy over and over and over and over and over and over. So basically, any game that I have to roll dice, I roll terribly all the time. We played, what was the game? It's kind of like Lords of Waterdeep. It was the Viking game.
Champions of Midgard.
Champions of Midgard. I played that game once, and I literally rolled the worst rolls every time. And I was like, I'm not playing this game anymore. So, this is the worst.
Yeah, I can't wait to play Dungeons and Dragons with you.
Yeah, it's great.
So I will.
Yeah, I rolled a cast a spell. You fail.
Critical fail. You hurt yourself.
Roll to block. You miss. It fails. Your block fails. Yeah, everything fails when I play Dungeons.
I'll say when we play the Voyages of Marco Polo, because we're going to meet up in the next week or so to play some games. And if we play Voyages of Marco Polo, I know the character that I'm giving you because his special ability is he doesn't roll the dice. He picks the numbers that he wants to put down on the board. And
the catch?
There's no catch. That's his special ability. And when I played the game for the first time, I was like, this is way overpowered. It's really not. But I will say that it's super nice to sit there and be like, oh, I need 3 gold and have exactly what you need to do that. So you can be really strategic about how you place your dice, because in that game, your dice are your workers and the value on the die matters. But it can fall into like last night when we were playing, my very first roll to start off the game, I rolled, and I'm talking a sea of twos. Everything was a two. Like I had like a couple of ones and 4 twos. And, that character would have helped out a whole bunch, you know? So, but, when I opened the game, I was like, oh yeah, I'm giving this guy to Chris the next time he plays, cause he hates getting screwed by dice.
Nice. I actually really like that mechanic where dice are your workers. I love that. And there are times where you're just like, I got a bunch of nothing, but I just think that's cool. It adds to me, just adds another element of chance to the game. And sometimes, especially if you're playing a game for the first time and you're like, I don't know this well enough. That's okay, because the guy who does know it well enough just rolled really bad. So sometimes it's nice.
Yeah, and the good game designers will design in really great ways to, you know, adjust your die rolls. The problem with Champions of Midgard when we played that one is the only way that you can re-roll your dice is to spend things that are worth victory points, and that can really affect the, you know, the way your score ends up at the end of the game. And it, so it hurts. It hurts a lot to re-roll your dice. And then you could potentially one again, you know, so. All right. Sweet. Good stories, everybody. We're going to move on to what's happening, where we're going to talk about some of the news in gaming. And we talked about a few things that we wanted to mention. One of the big things that's happened recently, there's been a whole lot of change this year in the board gaming industry. And part of it is due to the massive success of board games just as a whole. The really, really big figures that are coming in as far as sales are concerned. Kickstarter has done amazing things. There are companies that are big time contenders, and one of them is Asmodee. And what they've done is they've bought out other really big fish, kind of what we talked about in the last episode. But one of the really big things that they did, and we had alluded to this, was that they had changed their policies on the way pricing is going to be handled. And specifically with regards to online and brick and mortar policies. And it's kind of, I did some more research on this, and I've listened to a couple of podcasts, because really the tricky thing about this is that you kind of need to know someone who owns a store to really get details on how it's going to be implemented. But the basic principle behind what Asmodee is doing is, and what they kind of released, what they said they were trying to accomplish, is that they're going to basically make people choose whether or not they want to be an exclusive online retailer or a brick and mortar store. And the exclusivity that comes with that is going to restrict them from doing the other. So if you are a brick and mortar store and you say, I'm a brick and mortar store, then you're not going to be able to sell online and vice versa. And some stores have got around this. I know whenever I had first heard the news, I initially, you know, went straight to like Miniature Market and Cool Stuff Inc. I was like, well, what are they going to do? You know, they've got both. I've actually, they have separate LL or separate company names. So like really big stores, they have Cool Stuff Inc., which is their online presence, and they have Cool Stuff Games, which is their storefront. So they're going to be able to separate their business. But for smaller brick and mortar stores, if they have any kind of online presence, they're not going to have that luxury. And it seems kind of like the way the press release was announced was that we're doing this so that small brick and mortar stores will have a chance. And they'll have people, you know, kind of come to them more, and they'll have less competition from online retailers. And kind of what the way that it shakes out, the way that it seems to be happening, is that they'll just have some of their business taken away. And I don't know. I mean, what are y'all's thoughts? Have y'all gotten to read a little bit about this?
I did. I read through this a couple of times, and I looked at it really carefully, and then I went and I tried to basically read some stuff from people who own gaming stores, and the people who are talking about this are talking about it positively. At least from what I found, obviously I don't know everyone's opinion, but I read a few articles of people who are being really vocal about the whole thing. So basically the worry that what you have happening in the gaming industry right now, it's getting really big, and people are running game stores who aren't used to dealing with the volume that they're dealing with right now. So what they're doing, a game comes out and they say, well, that game looks like it might be popular. I don't know. I'll buy 100 copies. Well, they might sell 10. So what they'll do then is down the road, they'll sell 90 of those online through Amazon or whatever at a big discount, just because they need to clear out the space and they don't want to lose the money. Well, they get a bigger discount for buying 100 copies of the game. So what Asmodee's argument is that creates an unsustainable market, because people are buying huge gluts of games anonymously online at a big discount. Well, that's not really a sustainable business model. And I do get that part of the argument. The only thing, so ostensibly and at the beginning, yeah, this is something to try to make the board game market healthier, try to avoid basically an artificial bubble, something that's creating a market that doesn't really exist. Like, I get that, and that makes sense, and that's a logical argument. The thing that is weird to me about this is it feels very much like a monopoly-making corporate move, someone changing policies across the board that actually – it feels a little bit bullish, you know, saying, and the other thing about the press release that stuck out to me was they were saying that they're going to limit their publishers to, or their distributors to like 5 distributors. So that's a little bit, you know, concerning for people who use different distributors or whatever, have partnerships with different distributors. The other thing is that they're only going to allow certain people to sell their games online, period. Not just say you have to sell either online or in brick and mortar. They're only going to have a few. So you'll probably have Cool Stuff. I mean, you're not going to buy Asmodee games on Amazon, most likely. I could be wrong about that, but for the most part, a lot of people who sell online, even if they're only online, won't be able to sell Asmodee games. And that's a huge hit to some small retailers out there. And it also just feels a little bit like the big guy coming in and swinging their weight around to people who really don't have a say in the matter. They're like, hey, this is good for the board game industry. This is what we're doing. Get on board, or else you can't sell our games anymore. Because basically you're going to have an Asmodee seller account, and they can just deny your request to have one. And if you don't have one, you're not going to be able to sell Ticket to Ride. You know, you're not going to be able to sell Asmodee, Days of Wonder, Fantasy Flight, which, I mean, granted, in the grand scheme of things, sure, let's say you can't sell those games, not a big deal. There's tons of other games you can sell, but that's a big chunk of the market. And it's, you know, if I'm a small retailer, that might make me feel a little bit nervous and a little bit pushed around. So I don't know. Maybe it's good for the industry and maybe they know what they're doing. It just feels like it's a little bit of a strong arm way of doing it.
Yeah, and so the thing is, though, is that if you are a small store and you are not approved, which if you're a brick and mortar store, you are probably going to be approved to sell games in your store. That's not as big of a worry for some people. But the online thing, You do have to be an authorized retailer the way that they set it up. And I mean, they're going to have your own ID number. They're going to authenticate it with like this online tool that says, if you have any strikes against you, you know, you're out. You can't buy games right. until you get approved. So yeah, it is very, very much a weird type of thing that they're doing. But the thing that stinks is that you don't realize how many games they control now until you start looking at it, that arguably the most popular gateway game of all time, Ticket to Ride.
Yeah.
Any franchise version of expansion to that game, they control. Fantasy Flight, which is widely regarded as one of the highest quality as far as component wise, as far as just generally quality products, they have licenses, I mean, for miles, as far as Star Wars is concerned, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, anything that's good that you like, if you're into fantasy and board games, they're going to have their fingers in. And also, you know, just Asmodee, them before they bought everything, they had a massive catalog of games. So it's kind of tough because, you know, if you can't sell those games, then it does take a big chunk out of your inventory, and you can sell other games for sure. But the other thing that they had talked about, one of the podcasts that I was listening to, they had said that they talked to one of their store owners, and one of the things that they were going to do is they were going to, like you said, they're going to narrow down their distributors to five major ones. And then they're also going to level out the discounts that they give. So one distributor isn't going to be offering a 70% discount where one will be offering a 60%, because, you know, it's going to take away, it's going to level that out. And then it's going to increase the amount that, you know, or I should say decrease the discount for online retailers in certain amounts, like in bulk and things like that, so that it makes it more fair. But that, and to me, that kind of seems like the car dealerships, that they're saying like, okay, we have a set price and now you don't have to worry about haggling, which is another way to say like, you're just not going to be able to find any more really good deals. This is just the price and we're going to charge what we're going to charge. So that one was a little bit weird. And then also, kind of what you're saying. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like they're raising some of the prices for online retailers, kind of keeping them level for brick and mortars. And so it's a way to make more money partially, which, you know, you can't fault a company for wanting to make money. That's what they're in business for. But it does, you know, it can be seen as a little bit of a, you know,
it'll eventually even out. I mean, if their prices are too high, people start pulling out, they'll adjust their prices, hopefully. I mean, if they want to sell their product.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I managed a retail store for 8 years, so I have the retail insight into this. And one of the arguments that they were made is that people are running game stores and don't know how to do things like forecasting and inventory management. And that's probably true for a lot of people who run, you know, friendly local gaming stores. They probably don't really understand how to forecast product and how to sell it. It's really hard when you're in an industry that's having a huge boom in popularity. So it's really tough to forecast. And you might say, well, historically, we've sold 10 copies of games when they come out and they're popular, but now we're selling 50. So, you know, how do we manage that and how do we maintain that? So yeah, it's going to be more inventory management and maintenance and stuff like that. But like you were saying, Chris, you know, retail is consumer driven. I mean, if something's popular, it's going to sell, even if it's really expensive. So even if you have games, you know, Fantasy Flight and Asmodee and Days of, you know, Wonder games that raise in price, they're probably still going to sell. They might not sell as much, but in the long run, they probably will. If a game's popular, people are going to buy it, even if it's $10 more. Buying it online, the only other thing I see there is that there are, and I don't know the numbers on this, and I've been told that I would be surprised at how few people who buy games consistently buy them mostly online. To me, that seems silly because I feel like there's a lot of people who, number one, don't have access to a gaming store. And number two, you know, I mean, buying it online is so easy and convenient and cheap. Typically, you know, people are just going to buy it online is what I think, but I do a lot of shopping online, so I may be biased, but you know, according to Asmodee and according to a lot of people that I've heard, people going into the gaming store is far and away what drives the hobby and what creates new gamers and what, you know, what really brings people in and keeps people in to board gaming as a hobby. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I can think of the last I've bought recently. I've bought like five games. I bought three of them online, and I bought two in a store. The two in the store were more of an impulse. Like, I was at the store and I felt like I wanted to buy something to support them, so I just grabbed something. You know, but typically when I go out to buy a game specifically, I read reviews online, I watch videos online, I listen to podcasts about it, and then I go buy it online. But that may be just me. I don't know.
Yeah, it's tough. And the thing for brick and mortars is that the instances where someone comes in and does the and is that stereotype that you always hear about are so memorable. You know,
right.
And I was in Madness one time when somebody was doing that and was just really obnoxious about it and was talking really loudly about, oh, what's this one? Yeah, this is a really good game. Dead Winter. I like this one. It's really good. They had it on tabletop. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Oh, $60. Oh, that's crap. Yeah, no, buy it on Amazon. You can get it way cheaper. And I mean, there are employees like an aisle away. You know what I mean? It just feels, man, don't do that.
That's incredibly bad form. That is. No, and I agree. And that's, that is one of the arguments I made. I agree. That's a bad idea. Like, don't go into the game store, look at the game, and then stand there on your phone and buy it. You know, just don't.
Right.
It's rude.
And, you know, you can have an idea of, you know, and I've talked about this when we've talked about it in the past. You know, there are some things that I can't afford to buy at a game store for full retail price. I just can't do it.
Right.
If there's a game that includes, you know, a pound and a half of miniatures and is $150, I'm probably going to have to get that on some type of Black Friday sale, online clearance, something, because I can't, that's like almost four or five games that I could buy otherwise. I just can't always make that commitment. But, you know, I do want to try and support my local stores. I don't know. I'm still kind of on the fence about this policy. You really have to see how it pans out in the physical marketplace, because it's really nebulous right now. There's a lot of secrecy around it, or there's just a lot of it's just not very clear, and it's going to transition itself into physical prices that we'll be able to notice and see the trends of how that's being affected. But right now there's just not a lot of info on it. And
it is all speculation right now. And it's very easy to speculate. It's also very easy to be like, oh, the big dog is coming in and trying to change everything and feel very cheated by that. And this may end up being a really great move to make the industry more healthy and more viable. So we don't know for sure. I think it is easy to be like, oh, that's not cool, man. They shouldn't be able to do that. So it might be great. So I would be interested. I'm going to try to talk to the couple of game stores that we go to. I'd be interested to talk to the people in charge there and see what they think about that, because obviously they're going to know more about that than I do. You know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'd like to do that as well, especially the people at Role to Play. I think they might have some good insight on that. So one thing that I heard about, this came out from the Gamma Trade Show. So the Gamma Trade Show is kind of like an invite-only type thing, mainly for people in the industry that are, you know, not necessarily all game designers or publishers, but, you know, the Dice Tower's there, some really prominent bloggers and YouTubers and things like that.
It's mostly insiders and press, pretty much is what it is.
Yeah. So Eric Lang, who is the designer of, I mean, countless board games, he's kind of the all-star in the board game designing world right now. He is coming out with a Munchkin collectible card game. And this one didn't really wow me, because Munchkin is very successful. It's super popular because it's an easy point of access. But a collectible card game about Munchkin just didn't move my dial very much. But I will say they're introducing a really interesting policy on how they're going to sell their cards. So Steve Jackson Games has contracts and the ability to sell in big box stores. And he has been for a long time in Target and Barnes and Noble and places like that. And even some in like Walmart and stuff like that. So very, very big box.
Yeah, stores. You see it everywhere.
Yeah. And what he is doing, what they're doing with the Munchkin collectible card game, is they're selling starter packs at big box stores, and they are not selling booster packs. They're not even offering them to big box stores. They are only selling booster packs to local game stores. And what this is, so just imagine that Magic the Gathering had this same sales policy. You can get a starter deck at Walmart. You can get hooked on the game. But to get the boosters and to spend all the money, which is where Magic makes its money, is people buying and hunting for rares and chase cards, you have to go to a local game store.
You know, it's interesting, though. Can't you buy Magic starter decks at Walmart?
You can.
Yeah.
And you can also buy booster packs.
Do they have boosters? Okay.
Yeah, they have booster packs. They have a lot of products there.
I was going to say, I think they do unintentionally have that sales policy because they probably don't sell many boosters at Walmart. I don't know. They might.
Actually, they probably do. I say unfortunately because I'm a believer in supporting your local game store. So, for example, there's a one of the things I've heard. I watch a YouTuber. He does Magic stuff, and one of his things is, look, you can't play Magic at Target and Walmart. So buy your Magic products at the place where you can go and play and support the community.
Especially since the boosters are probably the same price.
Yeah, there's an MSRP, you know, on them, the game stores sometimes will sell them cheaper, depending on if you have a relationship with them and stuff like that, and they'll kind of sell them to you closer to cost. Which is cool. And so that's the kind of stuff you get at a local game store, especially when you get a relationship with the owner. Walmart's just going to charge the MSRP on it. Game stores will work with you. Now there's pros and cons to that. So for example, certain pre-made decks will come out with a money card in it, and the game stores realize that. And so at the game stores, like for the example, there was a Commander deck that came out a couple of rotations ago that had a big money card in it. And, the game stores are selling the Commander decks for like $75. Well, the MSRP is like 40, and Walmart just sells them all for the MSRP, regardless of of the cards that are in there. And so, you know, there's pros and cons. You can go get the deck with the money card in it for super cheap at Walmart, at Target. Whereas, you know, but then there's the, you know, well, once again, I'm a believer in supporting your game store. So, regarding that policy that you guys are talking about, I think it's great. I think it's good for game stores. You know, we were talking about the other policy being potentially bad for game stores, maybe. I think this is good. It's good for game stores. It depends on the popularity of the game. It depends on, you know, a lot of factors, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like you said, I can't get too hyped up about a Munchkin, you know, CCG, but I know a lot of people love Munchkin. And
exactly. The fans of it are going to be, you know, I think it will, because once again, it's a CCG is about playing with a community, you know, the strength of the CCG is getting together and playing it with people, and, CCG being collectible card game. And so, you know, there's something about it. I mean, you could go to Walmart and pick up a few packs, but then what, you know, where you're going to have to form your own community. So the good thing about that is you buy a few packs at the game store, you sit down, you play.
The other thing there that I love is that, you know, at the game store, you buy a few packs, you open them up, you play. And, you know, if there is a community there, then you can trade cards. You can talk to people about, you can hear things. You can just learn things and be involved in a community rather than just buying things and collecting them, you know, which is exactly what Pokemon cards have turned into.
Second to playing is trading, you know, with a CCG. And once again, you're in the game store, you got a community, you can do that. So
yeah.
I think it's good. I think it's a good policy. It'll remain to be seen if it's going to be successful for them. But
I think if it can be, Munchkin is the way to go. I mean, you know, that other than saying Magic, which at this point, Wizards of the Coast, they feel very disconnected from the gaming community in general. They feel very big, and Magic is just this huge.
Yeah, behemoth. Magic is what it is. It's huge. You know, it's always going to be.
I think if there's going to be another franchise that could implement policies that actually might be positive like that, Munchkin would be one. I think that's a great.
I think so too. I love to see a developer that's proactively supporting the mom and pop shops. You know, I love to see that.
Well, and I think this is a much more effective way to accomplish kind of what Asmodee is. And it's hard because Asmodee is a battleship. You can't just completely switch things over very easily. They have to change policies for their entire industry wide. And this is one game from one company. And it's also a game that lends itself to be collected. You couldn't do this with Ticket to Ride, for instance. I mean, you buy the game, the game. You have it. You could do it with X-Wing, you know, something like that, which they already kind of do. You know, they have that starter set and target, and they don't sell the individual ships. But I think it's a very cool idea. And, you know, I wasn't super excited about the game when I first heard about it, but it is designed by Eric Lang, who is incredible. He's a really good designer. And if there's anybody that can make a game about Munchkin appealing to me, it's probably him.
This is the guy who made the game that essentially Dice Masters is arguably based on, which is Courtiers. And I mean, yeah, there's tons of games that he made that this style of game could be really great, even though it's based on Munchkin, which could just be a great, you know, engine to put a, you know, fantastic game in.
Right. And he's the Dice Masters guy too. So he knows card games, he knows collectible games. I think this is a really simple, effective way to drive people to friendly local game stores where they can then play the game and, you know, just like you guys talked about, trade it and do whatever. So I'm excited about that. I think it's really cool. And I think it's simple and effective, a really nice way to do, to show support to the friendly local game stores.
It also seems like a friendlier way to try to accomplish the same thing, you know,
right?
To say, instead of restricting you guys, we're going to just give you something that no one else has, which,
right. You have special access.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like if you go to a convention, you have access to Kickstarter exclusives, whereas you would not normally have that unless you back it on Kickstarter. We're showing our loyal fan base some extra love. And I think that's really cool, which fans react really well to. And there are some diehard Munchkin fans, man.
You're not kidding, man.
So it will, I think it could be really good. I think it'd be really good. So one other thing that I'd put down for the news section that I kind of wanted to talk about was, Z-Man Games. So for people who may not know, Z-Man Games was founded by a guy named Zev Schlesinger, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly.
He is probably not.
Dro, right? So he is the, he's the guy, he's the Z in Z-Man Games. He's the guy who founded the company. He was pretty prolific when it came to discovering new games that were, industry shaping games. He found Pandemic, Agricola, Caverna, all these different, Carcassonne, all these different games that were that are mainstays on most lists. He was kind of the guy who discovered these, published them. He's just got an eye for really great games. He this past year left Z-Man Games. He went to work for WizKids. And he started a new board game division within WizKids to focus solely on board games. And WizKids, they make Dice Masters. That's their money maker. They also make HeroClix. They've made a few board games. They have one called Mage Knight that's very popular. That is a very legit, I mean, highly, highly ranked on Board Game Geek. Very good
game. Just played it for the first time this past week. It's great, but man, is it intense. But anyway,
I want to play it super bad. Anyway, he's gone to WizKids and he started a board game division within that company. And it's a company that's mainly focused, like I said, on collectible type games that make them a ton of money, but they haven't usually ventured out into the board game sphere very often. But the thing that's super interesting about this to me is that he is going to a company that, that has acquired the licenses to Marvel, DC, D&D, they have all these incredible licenses that they are using right now for all their collectible type games, but, combining these types of licenses that he has access to now with some fantastic board games. I'm really excited about the future of WizKid Games now that they've gotten him on board, because I think that there's going to be some really awesome games come out with some Marvel and DC and really cool licenses that I am a huge fan of that have not really had great tabletop representations. We talked about last week about how the Ninja Turtles was kind of the same way. there hasn't been a really awesome tabletop board game about superheroes or DC or Batman or anything like, so, I think that there's some really cool possibilities here. And there's obviously always been really great card games and deck building games and things like that about, you know, Marvel and, Batman and Superman and all these different DC characters and even Street Fighter and things like that. But there's never been like, I really like board games. And so I'm really excited about the possibilities that are going to come about with that. So definitely something to look forward to. I don't know. What do y'all think about it?
Yeah, that could be great. I don't know exactly how publishing rights work, and I know that there can be limited rights and limited licensing and things like that. So I don't know if the, you know, Star Wars X-Wing miniature license bleeds over into a Star Wars board game, because actually the Star Wars Rebellion board game is published by a different publisher. And so I don't know exactly how that stuff works, but this is a guy who's famous for publishing a ton of games that aren't licensed that are just great games that, like you said, shape the industry. I mean, you look at people's top 10 lists and there's going to be three of those games on half of people's top 10 lists of games that he's published and brought to light. So the cool thing that's about it is that WizKids arguably has, you know, a higher punching level than Z-Man, and might be able to actually bring out some, you know, some really big, great games and might really give him the opportunity to have a lot of freedom to bring some great stuff to the market. But yeah, I think it's exciting. And I don't know. I mean, Z-Man is great and they're a great publisher. It just makes me wonder what makes someone go from one good publisher to another publisher that does a totally different thing. It makes me wonder if he just needed more freedom or more autonomy or whatever. I don't know. I mean, either way, it's exciting. So,
yeah, they were just acquired by F2Z, or not just acquired, but they have like this,
right.
They have this parent company above them that kind of, it's F2Z Entertainment. They own Plaid Hat Games now, and they've kind of done a little bit of acquiring of their own while Asmodee was buying up everybody. So, but anyway, so interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff.
Interesting stuff. Segment. We just did called interesting stuff.
I don't know that
it's that is interesting.
I'll tack this into the news. I don't know if it really fits in news, but I'll talk about the game more when we talk about games we're excited about. But Wasteland Wednesdays is a segment. There's a game coming out called Wasteland Delivery Express, which I'll talk about later. It looks phenomenal, but I really want to point out, if you're interested in board games and the development process and the design process, Pandasaurus Games at their website. You can also go to the Wasteland Delivery Express Board Game Geek page. And Wasteland Wednesdays is a segment where the designers of the game talk about just the process, the design process, and what goes into it, and how they're getting to where they are. It's really, really interesting. Gives you some insight into, you know, how games get made and what the process looks like. Just really what's going into the game for every aspect, from the balance, the system, the artwork, the theme, all of that stuff. One of the guys, Matt Riddle from Dead of Winter fame, talks about theming and just really interesting stuff. So go check it out at pandasaurusgames.com or at the Board Game Geek page for Wasteland Delivery Express. It's a Wasteland Wednesdays, really interesting stuff and great insight.
Very cool. Very, very cool. All right, we've got Roll the Dice next. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the upcoming games that we're excited about or Kickstarter projects that we're kind of looking forward to. I know I put down a whole lot of stuff here. I may have to trim back, but I've got a lot of stuff I'm excited about. A few games that I've pre-ordered that I'm waiting. May is going to be my month, man. I am super excited. I've got Tyrants of the Underdark coming in. I've got 51st State. I've got the Essentials version of Viticulture coming in, which is a game about making wine. Cannot wait.
Yeah.
It's such a Euro, but I love it. anyway, so do you kind of want to talk a little bit about Wasteland Express? Now, you had this on your Roll the Dice.
Yeah, I do. I actually have two. But that's my first one. This game, I started reading this segment. Like, the game itself, I got interested initially because the artwork is cool. Like, it's so basically the game is it's a pickup and delivery style game set in a post-apocalyptic world. With this really fantastic comic book style artwork. It's very dark and gritty. It's a mature game. And then some of the artwork, you're like, whoa, would not play that with my kids. But it's post-apocalyptic. Think like Mad Max meets Borderlands, really, is what it looks like. The game has this modular board that's these octagonal tiles, and you put them out in the squares in between the octagons. Those become cities and settlements and things like that. And then all the different characters have a truck like, or a vehicle that's specific to them. It's customizable and it has the miniatures. So they'll have a little miniature and you can customize with armor or weapons or whatever on your little player card. And you'll be delivering like food and guns and, supplies to different settlements and things like that. And you'll have to travel through terrain. It's going to come with 10, basically 10 scenarios, and each one has a comic book that tells you the story of the scenario and what you're trying to do. And then it's also, you can make custom scenarios that are just, you could just set up the board and play a custom scenario. So it's infinitely, there's just an infinite amount of replayability potential in this game. Looks really, really great. The theme is, looks super strong with this. And obviously, Matt Riddle is Dead of Winter is one of my favorite thematic games ever. I mean, the theme in that game is just unbelievably strong. It plays so well, and you really feel like you are in a zombie apocalypse in that game. So he's a guy who's great with theme. And then the other two guys, Jonathan Gilmore and Ben Pinchback, great game designers. The game looks awesome. I'm super excited about that. The other one I am excited about is Santorini, which is on Kickstarter now. Really great looking game. It's, you know, the tagline is like, you know, learn it in 30 minutes, play it forever. Basically, it's a strategy game where you're building towers. You play as a Greek god. The gods have different powers, and you build up towers. Essentially, the goal is to get a tower to the third level. So it's kind of just, the game has been in development for 30 years. The designer has been using it in his classroom for 30 years and is now bringing it to light. You can go and kickstart it. It looks super simple. It's really pretty. The artwork is gorgeous. The tiles are cool. It's on this really cool raised board. It looks like an island that's coming out of the sea. And you've got this grid board where you build your towers, and your gods have different powers that let you build things up or down. And you can block other players. It's a strategy game. It looks like the depth on it is awesome, but it looks super simple to pick up and learn. I'm really pumped about that game. And it's just very, very pretty, and it looks super accessible too. So check that one out. Santorini.
Santorini. Sounds like a delicious wine.
Yes.
I did see that one on Kickstarter. It looked really cool. And I'm big time into the Greek mythology and things like that. And I know it might have been Roman. There were different gods that you could play, but I thought that was really cool, the different abilities they have.
Yeah, the theme looks really strong in this too, and it's really, really neat. He started out playing it just as a simple strategy game and then added the theme later when he was trying to bring it to market. But yeah, like I say, he's been kind of tweaking it and perfecting it over 30 years of using it in a classroom. So it's pretty, it's got a lot of play testing on it.
Yeah, that's true. 30 years. Good grief. All right, I'm going to read this tagline. Let's see if this grabs you. There is a post-apocalyptic world in the not-too-distant future. And players are competing to build colonies using leftover scrap material of a failed society. You interested? I was interested when I heard
it. I am interested.
This one
sounds good.
Dude, Chris, this one, I think this one would hook you. So this is... It's called Colony, but it when you read about it and when you kind of look at the different mechanics, it feels very much like a Civ building game in like a Fallout world.
Which sounds very cool.
Yes. So basically it's called Colony. It's released by Bezier Games, which they've made primarily city building, castle building games. They released Subdivision, they released Castles of Mad King Ludwig. They released a lot of different types of games where you are building buildings or cities. This one is kind of a resource management game, and they say it's a tableau building game, which I am such a huge fan of. That's essentially what Imperial Settlers is.
Mm-hmm.
But you're using dice as resources in this game. And they, you know, each colony that you have is going to kind of give you different variable powers, different things that you can do, different resources that you can store, and you're going to build new buildings and upgrade buildings that you might have, or kind of expand your colony. And you're trying to reach a number of points depending on how many players are in the game. But there's all different types of buildings. And it says it's kind of like Dominion, where you can pick a different number of the buildings and put them out to be bought and, you know, allow you to kind of build your city in a different way. So it sounds like there's a lot of replayability there, and, you know, I'm a big fan of the post-apocalyptic theme. I'm a huge fan of resource management and civ building.
Yes.
And I'm also a massive fan of using dice as resources or workers. It's a really interesting way to kind of change up the way, because it sounds kind of like based on what you roll is the type of resources that you can use in this game. And so it kind of creates some interesting chance, which I hope there's a way to maybe negate that a little bit, but it still sounds like it'd be really interesting. And so let's see, that's Colony.
Yeah. I had not heard about that one until I read it on your list. And then now I'm really interested in that, 'cause like you said, got lots of things that I really, really like.
Yes. It hits all the, it hits all the benchmarks for me of making me want to play it for sure. There's also a game coming out from AEG of Smash Up fame, and just cards. And I mean, they make great card games. AEG makes really great card games. They're coming out with a game called Mystic Veil. And so the theme of this game kind of feels like, from what I've heard, it kind of sounds like the theme doesn't really matter, but there is a new mechanic that they're using that is very interesting to me. And they call it a card crafting system. And essentially what it is this is a deck building game, but on top of building a different deck that you're going to be using, you're actually building your cards. And what you do is there are a lot of different sleeves that come with the game, transparent sleeves. Kind of think about, you know, the transparent sheets that teachers used to put down to display things on the wall. It's the same type of principle, but it's card sized. And you can put down a different sleeve on your card, and it will have a different ability printed on that sleeve. So you can sleeve multiple sleeves onto the same card and kind of change the way that your card performs or what it will produce and things like that. And you can buy these sleeves out in the middle of the table, and it kind of, you know, so not only are you building your deck, but you're building your cards as the game goes on, which is a really neat idea to me. And basically, you know, the theme is that you are, I think, what was it? Let's see. I keep on thinking warlock, not warlock, shaman. I think you're, no, a druid. That's what you are. You're a druid that's trying to protect the land from this evil.
One of those magical things. One of those.
Yeah. It's very fantasy, you know, blanket of fantasy just covering the whole thing. But the card crafting thing is very, very, very cool to me. And the other thing, let's see, I'll try and pare this down. Hold on. There's Islebound by Ryan Lockett. That one looks very, very cool to me. It's basically just an exploration game. You're going from different islands and trying to like build different cities and attack certain villages. It's the same person who made Above and Below, which, Chris, I know you played Above and Below with us. That one did not seem to grab you. Were you not a huge fan of Above and Below? Do you remember that one? It was the one that was where you were exploring the caves and you rolled dice to find out what type of encounters you had and everything like that.
I haven't played Above and Below yet. Chris, did you play Above and Below with them? Paul was saying he didn't think it grabbed you necessarily.
I did. I did play Above and Below. I enjoyed it. It was cool. I'm finding that I just probably don't enjoy engine building games as much as
blasphemy.
They just don't grab me like worker placements. Mm. I'm a worker placement guy.
You're a Euro gamer. Mm.
I enjoy them.
Worker placement is possibly my favorite mechanic too. It's very good. I do enjoy a lot of worker placement games. Yeah, Above it. So Islebound is if you get a chance, go check out the just Google Islebound. It's It's gorgeous. The art that Ryan Lockett does is incredible, and he does everything. He designs it, he publishes it, he draws it. He's like a jack of all trades. The other
I'll check that one out.
Yeah, the last one I was going to mention really quickly was 51st State. This one is a big it's a big hit for me because it is the game that Imperial Settlers was based on. But it is once again, a post-apocalyptic, not too near future America where you are playing different factions. You can be Texas or New York or things like that. So you're playing these different factions. There's not a Kickstarter, but a pre-order going on right now on the Portal Games website that is, they've gotten above $36,000, I think now, which has unlocked all of the little mini stretch goals. So Portal is doing a really cool thing where they are allowing people to pre-order the game and giving stretch goals. Essentially, it's not a Kickstarter, but they are giving stretch goal type rewards for people who pre-order the game. That's coming out in May, and I could not be more excited. It's a re-release. It's a master set. They're including some popular factions and some new, some kind of reworked art and reworked resources. It looks really cool. But it's different from Imperial Settlers. They say it's kind of a race to get points. You really don't have time to build an engine. You just have to race to 25 points. So it's similar to Imperial Settlers, but it's very different as far as the actual winning, the goal line is concerned. Mm. And that's really interesting to me.
Yeah. I'll have to check that one out. It's definitely one of those games that I looked at it, and initially it looks so similar to Imperial Settlers. I was like, I don't know. But I'll have to look more into that.
Yeah. Man, you could slap a different theme on Imperial Settlers, and I'll play it all day. I don't care.
I probably would, too.
Yeah. Although I do love the theme. Okay. So we are moving on to our analysis paralysis segment, where we are going to take a little bit of a deeper dive into a specific topic that is interesting to us this week. And this week we are talking about theming in board games, how it affects the game, how that affects our opinion of a game and if it's important or not. I know for me, I've got kind of a specific example for this, but do one of y'all want to kind of chime in on this one before I get going?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I say that theming doesn't matter a huge amount to me, but then I realize that certain games that when the theme is really strong, I will forgive weak or less than stellar mechanics any day if the theme is really, really strong with a game. So if the game has a great, strong theme, I love it. But if it doesn't, as long as the mechanics are good, I still can love the game. But, you know, there are some games like Dead of Winter is a good example of this. You know, Betrayal at House on the Hill, Mysterium, just games where if you can really get into the theme and really play it up and really get your group into it, it can really push a game over the edge for me. So I say it's not important to me, but if the theme is done really, really well in a game, it just really sucks me in. It'll make me want to play the game 5-10 times as opposed to being like, oh, that was fun. Let's play something else now. You know, so it can really push a game over the edge for me.
Yeah, I will say, for me, theming is pretty important. Mice and Mystics is a game that I got so into the universe of that game before I ever played the game that I was so excited to play that game before it ever hit the table because of the intro to the story that I had read, the miniatures that I had painted, all of this. I mean, the theme of that game was so strong to me, and the fact that you're playing a storybook, I fell in love with it. And that game mechanically is probably, you know, not super interesting as far as board games go. It's very simple. You're moving on spaces, you're rolling dice. It's a pretty straightforward dungeon crawl.
It's a pretty basic dungeon crawl. Yeah.
Yeah. But I will play that game over most other dungeon crawls.
It does have a really cool theme. It's really neat. You know, fighting these beetles and crawling through kitchen and, you know, it's just neat.
Yeah, you can. So, yeah, you can get a fork and launch mice across the room, and you can, right. You know, you get the fishing line that you can use like a grapple and pull yourself out of a river. It's just it's very cool. I love that. But the example that I was actually going to give was Mysterium, the one that you had mentioned. So I make the videos that I put out on YouTube, I mainly do how to play videos because there's a few games that the rule books are not super clear, Imperial Settlers being one.
By a few games, you mean about half of the games that come out?
Yeah. So
the rulebook is just okay.
It's confusing, and rulebooks are tough. It's hard to write a really good rulebook that is going to cover every aspect of the game and give everybody the need to know bullet points while still covering specific examples. Rulebooks are tough. But Mysterium was one that I had to do quite a bit of research to learn and to learn it correctly and how it plays. But it was one of those games that the theme was so pervasive whenever I played it, and I mainly played as the ghost, and that is thematically playing as the ghost is incredible. You can't talk, you're behind the screen, you're giving people visions, and it feels so thematic because you're not talking to people. People are trying to read your expressions and you're trying to kind of hide down behind the screen, and they include a free backing soundtrack for the game. So you can play music while you're doing it. I mean, we were playing one time when at mom and dad's house, and my nephew came in, and he's real little, but he came in and I was sitting behind the screen, and I have this music playing, and, you know, I'm handing out vision cards and I'm trying to be all secret secretive. And he comes in and he was kind of walked around the table and he looked around and he kind of looked like he didn't know what he was seeing, you know, and then he kind of walks up to his mom and goes, "Oh, spooky." And he just started saying spooky over and over again. I mean, even, you know, a toddler was walking around just realizing this is kind of a spooky theme, you know?
Yeah.
But I put up a how to play. This one was kind of, reinforced for me by, the response I've gotten from my Mysterium video.
Nice.
I did the Mysterium how to play video because the rule book was pretty confusing to me. And I wanted to kind of clarify it. But after I got done with that video, I was not super happy with how I explained it. I wanted to be very in depth about this is step one. You will set up the game this way because there's so many card shuffling steps.
Oh, yeah.
So many different types of steps where you have to put out cards on one side of the shield, or one side of the screen. The ghost has to put all these cards up. It has to match this way. You have this to remind you who you've given you. I mean, there's just so much to it. And for the video, I wanted to make kind of a spooky song. And so I recorded some music and put it up on the video. And I put the video up and I was just kind of like, this is just not my favorite video of mine. I don't think it's as clear or concise as it could have been. Well, so I started getting all these comments and people sending me messages on BoardGameGeek, and they're like, "Hey, what's the song that you used? And hey, this is so cool. Can you give me that?" I think it was the music mainly that drew people in, but people started just really responding to the Mysterium video. And I think part of it was because of the feel, because of the music and the theme that kind of matched with, I think, what the creators of the game wanting to do. And I got a huge response for that video. Whereas I feel like as actually explaining the game, there are some other videos that do that better, but they just, people don't react the same way. And I think theme really draws people in.
Yeah. Well, and that game is such a great example because the first time I played that game, you know, the first time you play a game, especially if you're doing it with a group for the first time and no one's played it, everyone's trying to figure it out. No one knows what's going on. You're like, okay, it's got this theme. Cool. I read the story. Rules, rules, rules. Let's play. Okay, cool. So to me, I was like, 6 of 10, you know, not bad. It's kind of cool. It's Mysterium. I mean, it's Dixit with a haunted house theme. Cool. And then I played it again, and I've only ever played that game as the ghost like you. So this time I played it and it was, some of the same people, but two new people as well. And it was, they were like, oh, you know, David, you be the ghost. You're a good ghost. And so you play it and you read the story, you know, like this is the mansion and there was a murder and haunted, and you read the whole thing. And then you give people their cards and then you read to them about their person. And you're like, oh, you're, you know, you're so-and-so and you're this, your specialty is the crystal ball and you, this is your family history and all this stuff like that. And then you come here and then you're like, now you have received a vision from the ghost. And then, you know, if the music is going and stuff like that, and then suddenly it's like, oh, 8 of 10. Okay. This game is awesome.
Exactly. Yeah.
And once you can really get into that theme, that game, like I say, it goes from a game that's okay, I mean, it's fine, to really great. And it's an experience and it's a story. And then everyone's really into it. And it just has a great feeling. And to me, the perfect example of theme really making the game, like, and I mentioned the two, like Betrayal at House on the Hill, which, you know, mechanically is an okay game. But the story is awesome, and especially if you're telling the story and you're like, you walk into the room, you see a body laying on the floor, you know, and you're reading every card like that. Same thing with Dead of Winter, Crossroad card pops up, and you're like, things are getting really bleak out here. Don't know how much longer we can survive. And you do it like that, and you suddenly get into the story of the game, and you're all telling a story together with rules, and you can win, and that makes it awesome. So to me, theme isn't necessary for a game to be great, but it can make a game really great, especially if you have the right group and if people are willing to get into it, you know?
Yeah, Ignacy Cevicek, the guy who designed Imperial Settlers, he did a Kickstarter recently for a book called Board Games That Tell Stories, and he is big on it. The guys over at Plaid Hat are big on it. The people who designed Mice and Mystics Mice and Mystics and Dead of Winter. But it can really make a game, you know, and I think you're seeing that in the industry right now. There's a trend towards that. The legacy games, the games that include apps, mm-hmm. To kind of present a campaign. One of the games that I'm most excited about, the first Martians, is actually a retheming of Robinson Crusoe.
Looks great. Yeah.
Ignacy Cevicek is releasing that game.
Are you a fan of Ignacy Cevicek?
You know, he's kind of a cool guy. I like him. You know, I like his accent. I'm a fan of Poland.
Once again, the Dicey Review drinking game. If you're drinking every time Paul says Ignacy Cevicek, you're wasted by now.
Yeah, you have alcohol poisoning at this point. Find the nearest hospital. Yeah, no, follow me on Twitter. You'll find out if I like
games. Like half of your Twitter feed is retweets of Ignacy Cevicek and Poland games.
Or direct tweets to him.
Yes. Yeah. I love you so much.
No, I love, hey, have I told you lately that I like Imperial Settlers? I just want you to know that I really like your game. Hey, good morning. By the way, I like your game.
Your game is great.
You had a great game.
Yeah. No, it is awesome though how much interaction you can get with him on social media. He's super involved, which is fantastic.
He cares about, I cannot tell you how incredible their customer service is, how incredible he is on Twitter about just answering your questions. I've been in the middle of a game of Imperial Settlers playing solo and had a question about a specific card, took a picture of it, tweeted it to him, and got a response in 5 minutes answering the question.
Nice.
Just, it's incredible the level of interaction that he has. But so, I mean, I don't know, to kind of reiterate that point, it's, you know, there's just games that are coming out that incorporate the theme, and it's very important to, you know, to make a successful game. It is. And it's kind of where Pandemic Legacy hit that sweet spot where the theme is incredible and mm-hmm. the mechanics are incredible. It's very rare, you know, because you have these games where you have this great theme, like the one that Chris had mentioned earlier, Champions of Midgard. Everybody was like, oh yeah, it's like Lords of Waterdeep with theme. But then you play it. Yeah, and it is true. There's a great theme to it. You know, you're fighting monsters and you're trying to defend your villages from Draugr, as he as the guy pronounced it. So, you know, and it's a great theme, but then some of the mechanics can be frustrating.
Right.
It's hard to marry those two things successfully and create a game that people are going to remember and talk about forever.
Yeah.
People are going to talk about Pandemic Legacy for years.
Oh yeah. For years and years. But the thing I do like along those lines is that it used to be that if a game had theme, it's Ameritrash and therefore it can't be a super deep game, but it's not necessarily true anymore. You know, you have Euro games with really great theming and you have, you know, games with a really strong theme, but also really deep and thinky and brain burny. But then you also still have games that are just, it's a thematic romp and it's fun. And I like that, but I like the fact that theme is becoming more important, you know, in the industry and in design and stuff like that. And I do like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. We could talk about it for forever, but it's a big win for me if a game's theme will draw me in. And half the time when I buy games on impulse purchases, it's because I've read about it on the back of the box and I've seen the front of the game and I'm like, oh yeah, yeah, I can get into
that. Oh, yeah.
And then
what happens?
It's just, oh, that mistake.
Yeah. All right. What happens to me is I walk through the gaming store and I see it and I'm like, ooh, this looks great. And then I go spend about 6 months researching it. and then I'll go and buy it. But I mean, seriously, if the theme is strong enough, I can see it on the box and it takes me down the rabbit hole that leads me to purchasing that game. So it can definitely draw me in.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I don't know, Chris, I was going to ask your opinion on, I know, well, cause a lot of the games that you're pretty into are more mechanically based, it seems like.
Yeah. So was there a question?
The question, no, I mean, just generally your thoughts on, you know, kind of the theming in board games and if that's important, if that's as important to you.
No, I mean, it is important, but it's not a make or break thing for me. If a game has good mechanics, like I love Settlers of Catan. It's one of my favorites. And if a game has, and it's not super deep and there's not a whole lot of mechanics, but if a game is fun, for me, the criteria is, can I sit down and play it with my family and enjoy it and explain it, you know, fairly quickly. And if it's got good mechanics and theme doesn't make or break, theme adds, I love a theme, you know, but it's not a make or break thing for me.
And it is really true. If it's kind of like what you were saying with Mysterio, if you have the mechanics were 6 out of 10, theme made it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah. And for me too, I think theme is really important with what group you're playing it with. So it is like, if I'm playing a game with my son, you know, who's 8, it doesn't, I mean, King of Tokyo is cool. We're monsters, but that game, it doesn't matter. I mean, you could be whatever, you know, so theme isn't as important in that group, but in my gaming group, of adults, it's far more important because we really get into it and we start telling that story together. So it becomes far more important.
Yeah. It really does group as well. If you're playing with some role players, man, you can make a game incredible.
Yeah, my gaming group also comprises, like, my gaming group also includes all the people who are in my D&D group as well. So we're very used to role playing together. So theme becomes big in the games that we play.
All right, so let's move on to when. This is basically where we talk about current games. Is we'll just wrap it up. What we've been playing recently. I know it hasn't changed a whole bunch. Chris, have you been more? I got Dice Masters.
Yeah, actually, just played some today. Played some Dice Masters. We played. We've been playing family games. You know, we played some Apples to Apples, which is really a non-game. I mean, there's no rules on that one. But yeah, we played some Dice Masters actually today. We went to play some Imperial Settlers the other day, but didn't have.
What?
You know, 3 hours to so he's like, let's pick a game that doesn't take 3 hours, you know? So, with my family, there's, you know, there's four of us and then we have a 3-year-old. So she's always on mom's team. So, there's four of us. So four people with Imperial Settlers, you got to have a good block of time to play it. So that's kind of what we've been playing lately.
Nice. As far as me, I have played so many games since last time we got together and recorded. I've been really trying. I want to write a review, like an article sometime, maybe for Dicey Review or something, just about board gaming and why it's become as important as it is to me. So what I've really been actively trying to get more people together to play board games, because the connections that you get are just really great and really awesome. And I find that if you make it a priority, you know, especially if it's with the family or if it's with your group of friends or whatever it is, if you make it the priority, then you can get together. So I've been hounding all my friends and we've been getting together and playing games and it's great. We played Time Stories, The Prophecy of Dragons. We didn't beat it. It's awesome. It's far more combat oriented than the other modules so far. I love it. It's really, really good. I've played a ton of, I've played some solo stuff actually, thanks to you, Paul. Played some Legends of Dritzt and love that game. That's really, really fun. And I say thanks to Paul because he gave me that game, which is awesome. And then I've played a lot of solo Imperial Settlers. Our group has played Zombicide. We played Black Plague Edition for the first time, which is so good. I like Zombicide anyway. A lot of people don't like it, and I understand completely why people don't. But Black Plague fixed a lot of the problems that Zombicide had for me. And now we will house rule some of the Black Plague rules.
So bad.
Oh, man. We need to get you over sometime for a Zombicide campaign. They're so fun. You play them with six. If you don't play them with six, you're at a a severe disadvantage because you have six guys, your people, who can help you kill zombies. So usually we play with four, and two people will just play two characters. So yeah, we definitely could always use more in our Zombicide stuff. So we've been playing some of that, played some Smash Up with another group. I played some Mage Knight, as I mentioned, which that game, man, that is an experience. I am really looking forward to digging into that some more. I played some King of Tokyo with Eli, which has been great. But yeah, right now my top stuff, really Imperial Settlers, because I've been digging into that a lot, and Time Stories with the group. It's just so good. I can't wait to get everyone back together and do it more. We got to beat it. We haven't done it yet, but I'm really looking forward to that. And then really D&D is our group has actually gotten together every week for the past 4 weeks. And so we've had some epic stuff. This last week was annoying because some people in our group made a really dumb decisions, but and then made us get into a fight with people that we needed to talk to. But it's so fun. It's so great. I love my character, and the group dynamic is a blast. So that's kind of what we've been playing, or I've been playing this past week.
The Voyages of Marco Polo has been the one we have really our teeth into recently. I got that game a couple weeks ago, played a couple rounds of it, or we played a couple times. It's laced in a big way because only begins the game, as we've talked about earlier. She tends to whoop my butt in that game a lot. And so we've been playing that quite a bit. And we've also, I've been playing Imperial stuff is always going to be on my list. I'm afraid maybe sometimes it'll get put off, but this past couple weeks it has not been pushed off. And the other game I've kind of got introduced to was Granja, however that's pronounced. It is a very, very typical Euro game about farming. It is about creating your own farm where you have your fields, you expand your field and put farm extensions down that your hand size, and you can produce goods and then upgrade those goods to make wine, pigs, and, you know, food and meat and things like that. It's a very good Euro, and one that if looking for a really relaxed build a farm game, it's a really good one. A lot of people have said that it kind of expands on the Agricola game being as demanding sometimes, but I've been playing. So
yeah, we're having some audio issues. So I will say this has been the Dicey Review, episode 2, and hopefully we'll get together soon to record some more. We have been Paul, Chris, and David Marchbanks, and until next time, we will see you at the table. There's no rule sheet, just an open sea. We don't care as long as you are here. Let's talk about some games.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We apologize for the audio issues, but please come back and check out episode 3 of the Dicey Review, where we'll be trying a new recording technique that should be much cleaner. We hope you have a great week, and until next time, we'll see you at the table. It's time for the Dicey Review.